The most asymmetrical opportunity in the world today. Welcome to this audio issue of Porter Stansberry's Complete Investor, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. Continuous innovations will send this major energy player higher. Sir Lionel Luck, who is the greatest lawyer in history. He holds the Guinness World Record for 245 straight murder acquittals, not in the United Kingdom or the United States, not in South Africa, Australia, or New Zealand. In Guyana, you've probably never thought much about Guyana. No reason why you would. Discovered by Columbus on his third voyage, 1498, he didn't bother stopping. Europeans wouldn't arrive in any number until almost 100 years later. It was the Dutch, not the Spaniards, who built the first colonies in this stretch of the South American jungle in 1580. For the next 200 years, the Dutch imported African slaves to turn Guyana's hot, fetid plains into large-scale sugar plantations. During the tumultuous Napoleonic Wars, control of the territory was conceded to the British. And they, although they get no thanks for it today, ended slavery in Guyana in 1834. To fill the resulting labor shortage, hundreds of thousands of indentured servants from India migrated to Guyana, including Sir Lionel Luck's great-grandparents. His grandfather, Edward Alfred Luck, was the first Indian lawyer in Guyana, admitted to the bar in 1899. The leaders of Guyana's drive for independence, 1966, as with most former colonies, rejected the economic system of the British Empire in favor of socialism. In 1970, Guyana's Prime Minister, Forbes Burnham, declared Guyana would become the world's first cooperative republic. Major industries like bauxite and sugar were brought under state control. Banks were nationalized, and soon the country's economy was subject to strict price controls. As you know, socialism works great until you run out of other people's money. But it doesn't work at all if you have no money to start with. Real per capita GDP in Guyana fell from around $600 at independence to roughly half that 20 years later. Virtually everyone who could leave the country did so. And soon Guyana was in a foot race. No one could afford shoes, with Haiti for the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. That's when its neighbor, Suriname, thought it a good time to poach what little resources Guyana had left. Suriname's primary national export was aluminum. So when its bauxite mines began to run dry, it looked across the river to Guyana. Suriname argued that the Quarantine River, a border agreed on since 1831, and one that appears on all international maps, wasn't actually the border at all. Instead, Suriname claimed the real border was an entirely different river, the New River. It conveniently sits in 6,000 square miles inside Guyana's territory, which is indeed rich in bauxite. It fell to Sir Lionel Luck to evict the Surinamese invaders, without much to back him up. At first, he called them illegal immigrants. Suriname's premier responded by kicking out about 2,000 Guyanese from his country, claiming that they were illegal immigrants. So Luck decided to appeal to a higher authority. He flew to the Netherlands, Suriname's parent country, to complain directly to Queen Juliana. It didn't help. In August 1969, Suriname forces flew into the New River area and set up a 3-square-acre military camp, complete with barracks, bunkers, field refrigerators, and a big, obnoxious flag. The Guyanese responded with Operation Climax, 2 de Havilland DHC-6 twin otter planes with nose guns and 44 armed soldiers. The battle was like two retarded kids trying to shoot each other with paint pellet guns. The Surinamese attempted to block off the half-built landing strip with 200-liter metal oil drums, but the Guyanese landed the planes anyway. They got lucky. The propellers just cleared the top of the drums because the plane's wings, with the propellers, are mounted on top of the roof of the plane. After a brief firefight, the Surinamese abandoned their camp, along with all their refrigerators and jeeps, and fled in boats. The Surinamese Five Stars flag went down. The Guyanese Golden Arrowhead went up. As the Surinamese retreated from Guyana, for the time being, poor Sir Lionel Luck retreated from politics and went back into law. And you'd never believe what happened next. Jim Jones hired him to handle a paternity case. In fact, Luck was supposed to be in the notorious cult leader's camp the day Jones put cyanide into the camp's flavor aid and ordered everyone to drink it, killing 900 people including 200 children. Luck had had enough. Like virtually everyone else who could possibly afford to leave, he moved to Texas. And the resource war between Suriname and Guyana spread to oil. Which brings us to the point of the story. Oil companies have been nosing around in Guyana since the 1950s, but only one well had delivered more than a trickle of the black liquid. By the 1980s, a few majors, including Mobil, Total, and BHP, had shown interest. Finally, in the late 90s, Guyana decided to award an 8.7 million-acre oil exploration lease to Canadian explorer CGX Energy. And that lease, you guessed it, was smack dab in the middle of the New River area Suriname still claimed as its own. Ever since the Camp Climax paintball match, Guyana and Suriname had continued to snipe at each other over the border, seizing each other's fishing boats and locking up fishermen. They'd eventually established a Guyana-Suriname Cooperation Council, where the meetings frequently erupted into brawls. When CGX Energy trotted out its first offshore platform in 2000, on one of two promising oil fields in the disputed territory, Suriname sent a fleet of gunboats and dragged the Canadian rig right off. That touched off yet another international crisis, and a seven-year-long stalemate on any oil exploration and drilling in the area. Guyana eventually took the case before the highest court they could, the United Nations International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, ITLOS. With the help of an illustrious team of international lawyers, ITLOS determined a definite border in 2007. It was a positive ruling for Guyana, with the majority of desired drilling sites ruled to be within Guyanese territory. During the standoff, CGX and other oil companies had used their time wisely, honing 3D seismic technology to accurately map drilling sites. With the area finally open for business, explorers flooded in starting in 2008. The explorers soon struck black gold, with over 130 high-quality oil-bearing sandstone reservoirs stretched out primarily across an offshore area called the Stabroek Block. Since 2019, when Stabroek production began in earnest, crude oil production in Guyana has exploded from 15,000 barrels per day, BD, to over 630,000 barrels per day, with 1.3 million barrels a day expected by 2027. The oil boom has contributed double-digit yearly growth to the Guyanese economy since 2020, and made it the world's largest oil producer per capita. And, happily for the Guyanese, free market reforms have been in place since the 1990s. The result? Guyana is one of the faster-growing economies in the world, with an incredible 43.6% GDP growth rate in 2024. Today, the Stabroek Block is owned by three large oil companies: China's CNOOC and America's Chevron, CVX, and ExxonMobil, XOM. All three companies stand to make a windfall on one of the world's largest conventional oil fields, with an all-in cost of production around $30 per barrel. That's including all exploration, development, operating costs, taxes, royalties, etc. That makes the field one of the lowest cost sources of offshore, high-quality light sweet crude in the world. A major focus of our investments in Complete Investor this year is in energy. As President Donald Trump tries to run the economy hot with huge government deficit spending and manipulated interest rates, we think energy prices are very likely to chase gold and silver much higher. Thus, all three of these companies will likely perform well in 2026. But only one of these companies is about to double the size of its proven reserves in the Permian Basin thanks to a new, proprietary way of increasing its recovery rates from America's richest oil fields. This new technology, along with its booming Guyana oil field, positions this month's recommendation to be the world's leading energy producer for the next decade. Porter, they ring-fenced me. I got my start as an oil and gas investor in early 2010 when I received a call from my longtime best friend, the Texas legend, Cactus Schroeder. Since the early 2000s, I've hunted and fished all over the world with Cactus. He's hosted me on his incredible mountain ranch in New Mexico, where I've shot trophy elk, and I've hosted him on my fishing yachts in the Bahamas, where we've caught massive blue marlin. In between, there's hardly a fish, a fowl, or a monster on land or sea that we haven't harvested and eaten. But when we first met each other, he was a poorly paid landman, yes, like in the show, and I'd just launched my very first publishing company. We were both still flying coach. But after fishing with Cactus in Panama in 2002, I knew I'd met someone very special who was going to do great things in life. Cactus' life changed forever in the mid-2000s when he, Bartholomew Witham, and some other partners leased 5,000 acres in the middle of nowhere in South Texas. They found some good geology and hit on some sour gas wells using a new technique, horizontal drilling. This was only a few years after George Mitchell had cracked the very first shale gas field, the Barnett Shale, near Fort Worth, Texas. In South Texas, Cactus was using the same techniques as Mitchell. He was drilling 13,000 feet underground and then drilling 1,000 feet horizontally. The land was cheap, so they leased some more acres, with their position growing to 50,000 acres across Clarns and Bee County, Texas. With gas prices trading over $12 in June of 2008, it looked like they were going to print, but then everything collapsed. Gas prices plummeted after the global financial crisis, falling to under $3 by the fall of 2009. Suddenly, they were in danger of losing their field. Meanwhile, in October 2008, right in the middle of the crisis, a small company called PetroHawk Energy drilled STS #1H well in LaSalle County, just a few miles down the road from Cactus Lease. It not only produced a huge amount of natural gas, but it also produced a valuable liquid hydrocarbon called condensate, a very lightweight form of crude oil. As word leaked out, more and more prospectors began drilling in South Texas. Drilling permits in the region grew from 26 in 2008 to over 1,000 by 2010. Cactus called me one day in early 2010. He sounded like a kid on Christmas morning. "Porter, you wouldn't believe it. They've ring-fenced me. They've been drilling all around my land, on all sides." I was a little confused. It sounded bad to me at first. Didn't that mean Cactus couldn't easily lease any more ground, because he'd been surrounded? I was thinking that Cactus was trapped, but I had it all wrong. Cactus explained the situation as though talking to a small child or one of his incredible bird dogs. "Just imagine the biggest, best friend you've ever had in your life, talking very slowly and explaining how he was about to make the greatest fortune of his life. Porter, every well they drill is a well I don't have to drill. You see, they're spending millions of dollars to prove the value of my land. I've got working rigs surrounding my entire property now. And the richest part of the trend, the wettest part, runs right through my ranch in Karnes County. These wells are full of condensate. And that's worth a lot more than just dry gas." The biggest story of my career on April 14, 2010, in a letter titled "All the Oil in Texas," I broke what I still believe was the biggest story of my entire career, the story of the coming Texas oil boom. Not only was America not facing peak oil, it was about to experience the biggest oil boom in history. "I expect Eagle Ford to yield more than $2 billion in oil and gas by 2013 and to increase steadily for at least 20 years. These numbers mean Eagle Ford will probably produce hundreds of billions worth of oil and gas over the next 30 to 40 years. Even though very few people believed me at the time, I was being conservative. Karnes County wells alone have, so far, produced 1.46 billion barrels of oil. With an average price of $70 per barrel, that's already more than $100 billion worth of oil. Across the entire Eagle Ford, more than 10 billion barrels of oil have been produced so far, more than $1 trillion in oil and gas revenue." It was around then that AOG, formerly Enron Oil and Gas, made an announcement that stunned the world. It was no longer going to be in the natural gas business. AOG drilled 16 delineation test wells along a 120-mile line in the Eagle Ford, spanning six counties. They estimated almost a billion barrels of crude oil would be produced from their properties in the field. AOG CEO Mark Papa told the press, "We believe the South Texas Eagle Ford horizontal crude oil play will prove to be one of the most significant United States oil discoveries in the past 40 years. Within a few months of that call, Cactus and his partners sold their acreage for $1.4 billion to Norway's Statoil. And it was shortly thereafter that Cactus told me about the monster field that would become the Permian Basin. Back then it was just called West Texas. And what made it so special was that its geology was built like a layer cake. Several different massive shales, stacked one on top of the other, were spread over millions and millions of acres. Thus I knew, as early as 2011, that truly unprecedented supplies of crude oil, natural gas, and condensate were going to hit the market. Over the next several years, I made it rain for my readers as this incredible economic engine transformed the entire world. The easiest call was realizing how much natural gas America could produce, almost for free, as the oil production also was generating huge amounts of associated gas. In my July 2011 issue, I first predicted that natural gas would become the energy of the 21st century, and that America would come to dominate the liquefied natural gas, LNG, industry. I recommended investors buy Cheniere Energy, LNG, which at the time was building its first LNG export facility. Its shares have gone up about 2,000% since then. Keep in mind, at the time America exported virtually zero LNG and most people didn't believe it was possible. In fact, I knew about Cheniere because I'd originally shorted the stock in 2006. The company's original business plan was to import natural gas into the US because everyone was so afraid of peak oil. I knew that was madness. As I titled my newsletter that month, the stock went from $30 to $3. But as soon as Cheniere decided to reverse engineer its Gulf Coast facility to export gas, I knew it would make investors a fortune. Then, in my December 2012 issue, I predicted US shale surpluses would make America the world's leading crude oil exporter. Everyone thought I was crazy. It was against the law, at the time, to export crude oil. But I knew the law would have to change because the coming wave of oil production was going to flood the American market. Until the law changed, though, it was easy to see that natural gas liquids, NGLs like propane, would be the only legal way to export the huge energy surpluses. I recommended Targa Resources, TRGP, as the only midstream operator on the Gulf Coast with large propane export facilities. Targa's market cap has ballooned from $5 billion in 2012 to over $44 billion today. My point is this: long before anyone else knew what was happening, I was certain that America would, once again, become both the largest producer of hydrocarbons and the world's largest hydrocarbon export nation. And I knew all of this because of Cactus Schroeder. Since then, U.S. crude oil production has tripled. Today, the U.S. is the world's top global energy exporter. One-third of U.S. hydrocarbons now clear global markets. America leads the world in crude oil production with 13.2 million b/day, ahead of Saudi Arabia and Russia. It is also the world's leading crude oil export nation. In 2025, U.S. LNG exports hit a record 111 million metric tons, first country ever over 100 million tons in a year, 20 million tons ahead of Qatar. U.S. exports represented 25% of global supply. Today, once again, the peak oil people are starting to chirp. The shale fields are going dry, they claim. Doom is upon us. Nonsense. The single greatest business in American history is about to flex its incredible technical capabilities and launch the second global shale revolution. I hope that by now you've come to trust what I say about oil and gas, not the doomsayers. And here's what no one else will ever tell you. ExxonMobil is now producing almost 600,000 b/day from only 1,250 wells in the Delaware Basin, which is part of the much larger Permian field. That's a 60% increase in production from last year. Rather than going dry, Exxon is massively increasing output from its existing wells. That is a godlike increase in production from a large number of existing wells. Exxon says its proprietary technology and fracking materials have greatly increased recovery rates, from 10% of total resource to 15%. Across all of its Permian wells, Exxon now expects 50% higher recovery rates by 2030 with 40% lower drilling costs. This lowers its production break-even to $30 a barrel and greatly expands its total resource. And if you think about the math, this means a doubling of their proven reserves in the Permian. But before we get to how this is possible, let's step back and admire the incredible business that is ExxonMobil. Buying the greatest American company of all time, I believe that, along with Carnegie's U.S. Steel, Buck Duke's U.S. Tobacco, Candler's Coca-Cola, Alexander Graham Bell's Bell Telephone, Ray Kroc's McDonald's, Henry Ford's Ford Motor, Watson's IBM, and Steve Jobs' Apple Computer, John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil is one of the institutions most responsible for the modern world. Standard Oil produced unprecedented wealth for its owners, while improving the lives of all of its customers. It's widely believed that Standard Oil and its successor companies have paid more than $500 billion in dividends to investors since the early 1900s. Only U.S. Tobacco and its successor companies have paid out more to investors, but it does depend on how you count it. Apple, AAPL, is probably the all-time leader in wealth creation. At least in nominal terms, Apple has returned more than $800 billion to its investors in both dividends and buybacks. But in real terms, adjusted for inflation, the two leaders are U.S. Tobacco and Standard Oil. Standard Oil's origins trace back to the late 19th century with the formation of Standard Oil Company in 1870 by John D. Rockefeller. In 1882, it became the Standard Oil Trust, dominating the U.S. oil industry until its breakup in 1911 by the U.S. Supreme Court under antitrust laws, resulting in 33 separate companies. A key successor was Standard Oil of New Jersey, which became Jersey Standard, and later Exxon. The other was Standard Oil of New York, which became Socony, and later Mobil. Jersey Standard grew into a global leader in oil exploration and refining, acquiring Humble Oil in the 1930s and rebranding to Exxon Corporation in 1972. Mobil, formed from the 1931 merger of Socony and Vacuum Oil, focused on marketing and international expansion. Exxon and Mobil merged on November 30, 1999, to form ExxonMobil. Standard Oil, ExxonMobil, NYSE, ZUM, is an integrated energy company, which means it doesn't only pump the oil out of the ground, it also refines its upstream oil production into products and distributes them around the world. Exxon, an end-to-end business behemoth. Exxon's downstream businesses are enormous, the largest integrated products and chemicals businesses in the world. Exxon's energy products makes conventional and lower emissions fuels, aka gas, diesel, aviation fuel, for personal and commercial transportation. Exxon is the largest non-state-owned oil refiner in the world, with over 50% of its refining capacity located in North America. Exxon's chemical products unit refines oil into polymers, aka plastics, and other chemicals used in everyday products across multiple industries, such as packaging, automotive, and consumer goods. ExxonMobil is the world's leading producer of polyethylene, with more than 60% of its chemical capacity located in the U.S. Finally, Exxon Specialty Products produces lubricants and other high-value products for industrial, commercial, and infrastructure markets. To use a metaphor from history, if you view an oil field like a modern whale, an earlier source of oil-based energy, Exxon owns the boats, kills the whales, refines the oil, makes the candles, and sells them all over the world. While these downstream businesses produce good results, 33% of earnings 2025, the real purpose of these businesses is to provide a hedge against the oil price. When oil prices fall, then its downstream businesses make much bigger profits. When oil prices are high, then Exxon's upstream assets shine. So, while 2025's $22.2 billion upstream profits were down 11.6% from 2024, the $10.9 billion Exxon earned from products was up 12.1%. But as you can see from the relative numbers, the show is upstream. That's where the discovery, the innovation, and the incredible technical expertise makes ExxonMobil what it is, the world's leading energy company. ExxonMobil has five upstream businesses. These are conventional, unconventional deepwater heavy oil LNG assets. Conventional oil and natural gas are the largest and most diverse piece of the upstream portfolio. The company has operations spanning a wide range of conditions in nearly 20 countries. ExxonMobil's conventional assets produce more than 1.3 million net oil equivalent BD. But that's not where Exxon is growing the most. ExxonMobil's upstream investments are focused on what Exxon calls advantaged assets. These are assets where Exxon's engineering expertise can produce low-cost, high-margin projects. These include unconventional plays in the U.S., the Permian, deepwater developments in South America, Guyana, and LNG ventures globally. An entirely new way of drilling. The Permian Basin is ExxonMobil's flagship unconventional asset, where it holds extensive acreage in the Delaware and Midland sub-basins following a 2024 merger with Pioneer Natural Resources. In Q4 2025, Exxon's total Permian production hit a record 1.8 million oil equivalent barrels, BO, per day, with the highlight coming from its Delaware Basin activities that I mentioned earlier. Exxon's engineering expertise is transforming this portfolio in ways that no other producer can match. Currently, ExxonMobil forecasts annual Permian growth of approximately 200,000 BO/D this year, with volumes projected to exceed 2.5 million BO/D beyond 2030. How? Exxon has developed an entirely new way of drilling and fracking Permian wells that models each well in three dimensions, instead of only two. Rather than simply picking a depth and a lateral distance, Exxon is managing each well as a cube. This involves drilling and fracking an entire cube of subsurface rock, a three-dimensional section. Exxon drills and completes multiple horizontal wells across the stacked layers of the reservoir, called benches, at different depths, simultaneously from a single surface location or pad. By treating the reservoir as a unified manufacturing process, cube development optimizes spacing, timing, and completions to extract hydrocarbons more efficiently, and it vastly increases recovery rates. This engineering strategy, plus a new proprietary fracking material, has vastly increased Exxon's drilling efficiency, with total recovery rates growing from 10% to 15%. This, along with lower drilling costs, implies the value of Exxon's existing reserves will double over the next 5 to 7 years. Following its 2024 Pioneer acquisition, Exxon has about 18 BO in net recoverable resources, at current recovery rates, across 1.4 million net acres in the Permian. Proven reserves in the Permian are currently 10 billion to 12 billion barrels. By increasing its recovery rate and lowering its drilling costs, I expect Exxon to materially increase both its net